Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back with another EB Medicine special, or evidence-based medicine. They are an excellent website full of great information. We're going to talk about them more at the end of the podcast. But as you may remember, we cover a monthly special on EB Medicine topics. And this time, I chose for us to go over another pediatric special, which is specifically about the febrile young infant. You may be thinking to yourself, like, yeah, these are scary because of a number of reasons. So they can have very serious pathogens and may not always have these obvious ill-appearing presentations. They can have very deadly consequences when missed. And those who are managing them can also be nervous as well and scared, which can increase the stress for an already stressful situation. But you may also be thinking to yourself, like, hey, this is actually pretty structured and methodical, and we go through it, and it's no big deal. And yes, there's some degree of that, but there's a lot of decision-making still that comes up. And I felt like EB Medicine did a really good job breaking down a topic that I have wanted to cover for a while. So I thought this was very natural for me to discuss this on the podcast using this as the backdrop. It is true that we are going to have a certain amount of quote-unquote routine approaches. And that's mostly with the neonates because it's so structured because basically we're going to do everything with them. But for others, we find this a little more challenging. Why do we have to do a big workup in the first place? What's the big deal? Well, for children 90 days or younger, and sometimes the cutoff may be 60 days or younger, their immune system is very immature, and they're at high risk for serious bacterial infections, or SBIs, and invasive bacterial infections, or IBIs. And what makes it more challenging is the lack of social responsiveness, such as a social smile, verbal cues, and like I said, even the well-appearing young infant can harbor serious infections. Plus, from a medical legal standpoint, the most common diagnosis in pediatric malpractice cases in the emergency department involves bacterial meningitis. I do want to cover a couple of quick terms here. So any infant that's 28 days or less is a neonate. And then young infants are, like I said, somewhere between 60 to 90 days, most of the time 90 days or younger as the cutoff. When we're talking about a fever, we're talking about a rectal temperature of 38 degrees Celsius, which for us Americans is 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. And serious bacterial infections, there's quite a few of them, and some of them can involve invasive bacterial infections or IBIs. So our two main IBIs are bacterial meningitis or bacteremia/sepsis. And then other serious bacterial infections or SBIs include urinary tract infections or UTIs or pyelonephritis, which is the most common that we'll see, pneumonia, specifically involving focal consolidations, bacterial enteritis, cellulitis, abscess, osteomyelitis, and septic arthritis. What defines a full septic workup? This can have some variability, but essentially it is going to be a complete blood cell count, or CBC, plus or minus C-reactive protein, which is CRP, and procalcitonin, often abbreviated as PCT, if they are available. Now, the procalcitonin can be available, but may not be coming back right away. Same thing for the CRP. So a lot of us are still using, in the rural settings, or those who are working in smaller hospitals, just the CBC. Maybe sometimes we'll throw in a CRP, but again, that's going to vary based on the availability. Most of the time, PCT is not going to be available. A blood culture is essential. Urinalysis with culture is going to be a big one, which we're going to talk about more here as we go through this. Serum glucose. I added a complete metabolic panel because usually you want to check for electrolytes and you need the liver enzymes. How do you do that? You can do a CMP. Cerebral spinal fluid, or CSF, cell count, glucose, protein, and a culture. Stool cultures are only as indicated, as well as chest x-rays are only as indicated. And we'll talk about that a little more towards the end about what specific situations we're going to use that. Finally, herpes simplex virus, or HSV, testing is going to be used as indicated. With neonates, we're usually going to be doing this, but in older populations, probably not. The next thing I wanted to cover are, what are the causes of fever in well-appearing young infants? When it comes to SBIs, we're usually seeing UTI, but we can also see again bacteremia, bacterial meningitis, pneumonia, soft tissue cellulitis, bacterial enteritis, as well as bone and joint infections such as septic arthritis. For viral infections, we're looking at enterovirus, upper respiratory tract infections, bronchiolitis, viral gastroenteritis, and neonatal HSV infections. What about for ill-appearing infants? Well, keep in mind that they may have a fever, but not always. And so that could be the tricky part with this, because there's plenty of things that can make children ill at very young ages. But sometimes the fever may be something that just happens to be a red herring in the mix. So we have to keep in mind other causes besides infectious. Let's start with infectious causes, though. So these serious bacterial infections, like we were talking about earlier, neonatal HSV infections, enterovirus, and RSV infections. Cardiac causes may not always be febrile, like we're talking about, but ductal-dependent left-sided or right-sided obstructive lesions can be a common cause for the ill-appearing infant. Metabolic causes are another common example. Inborn errors of metabolism or congenital adrenal hyperplasia are both causes from a metabolic standpoint. And then when it comes to gastrointestinal causes, the main one we think about is malrotation with volvulus. So the actual diagnosis of HSV can be rather challenging because many of them may not have cutaneous symptoms. And the table that was listed in EB Medicine was really good. So I took that table. It's on the website for you to look at. Remember to go to totalem.org. and look under emergency professionals, where you'll be able to see the blog and podcast, specifically our show notes. And that's going to be under podcast number 174. It breaks it down by looking at it from HSV type, if it basically involves skin or mucosa, the central nervous system, or if it's disseminated. It's worth keeping in mind the mean age of presentation is usually less than 20 days and often within the first couple of weeks of life. So in our 21-day or younger infants, we really need to keep in mind that we should probably consider testing for HSV, even if there's no history from the mother or no known exposures. The history and physical are vital components still with evaluation, in addition to the lab test that we were talking about before. For history, the main things we're going to be asking about is the method of the temperature measurement, whether it's rectal, tympanic, axillary, forehead, whatever, viral symptoms, such as congestion or runny nose, feeding, whether it's poor or slow, urine and stool output, fussiness and or lethargy, the birth history, including gestational age at birth, prenatal laboratory studies, such as if there is screening for group B strep or HSV. And then finally, the family history of early unexplained deaths or a metabolic disease are all essential. Keep in mind, you can definitely ask for more questions, but when we're approaching this, we want to have a systematic approach. We need to keep in mind that these are the main questions in the history that we need to know that can help us further figure out what is going on. What about the physical exam? Some of the main things I'm going to be looking at is, are they difficult to arouse or console? And here's one to really keep in mind, because that can be suspicious for meningitis. More specifically, this is something I've learned attending some pediatric emergency medicine stuff, is that if you bounce an infant and they become more upset versus consoled, that could be concerning for meningeal irritation, which makes sense as you're bouncing the infant around and everything's getting irritated there, versus that normal response of they become relaxed and more comfortable. Think meningeal irritation, think meningitis. The next thing we want to assess is that anterior fontanelle for fullness or elevation. Does the patient have jaundice? Are there signs of acute otitis media? Respiratory exam should include looking for tachypnea, accessory muscle use, crackles or wheezing. We also want to listen for a heart murmur and check for pulses. Now, keep in mind, these pulses can be weak, which would be, again, concerning for shock and sometimes other pathology, especially of the heart. The question becomes, you've done this assessment, you have labs coming back, you've done your history and physical. How do you manage these patients? And there's a variety of risk stratification tools with varying types of data and suggestions. The most common ones that we see and use are the Boston criteria, Philadelphia criteria, Rochester criteria, the step-by-step approach, and the PCARN algorithm. With the first three, the Boston, Philadelphia, and Rochester criteria, They were all developed in 92, 93, and 1994, respectively. So these are ones that are a couple of decades old. We need something newer. That's where the step-by-step approach and the PCARN algorithm come into play. Keep in mind that the Rochester Criteria step-by-step and PCARN are all available on MDCalc. So if you're looking for something where you want an easy reference tool to pull up, although I was able to find images for all of these to go through the algorithm and the breakdown of the criteria on other websites, but MDCalc does a nice job of breaking down the cutoffs and criteria that you can use. It is also important to know that the PCARN, which PCARN stands for Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network, has not yet been externally validated and should currently be used only in infants aged 29 to 60 days. The reason why is this is due to the elevated herpes meningoencephalitis risk and the limited number of episodes of bacterial meningitis in other age groups. So basically, don't use it for children less than 29 days old. The next question becomes, okay, how do we do this by age? Well, there are a couple of different algorithms to use or clinical pathways. EB Medicine did an excellent job breaking it down by the age group. So they have one for 28 days or less. They have one for 29 to 56 days. And then they have one for 57 to 89 days of age. They have some nuances between each one of them. I'm not going to go through every aspect, but break down just essentially the key points. And then you can go to the show notes to check it out a little bit further. So for the febrile infant age 28 days or less, it's pretty straightforward. Are they ill appearing? Are they well appearing? If they're ill appearing, you need to do the ABCs, perform that full septic workup, and give them antibiotics. Especially if you're worried about HSV, make sure to include IV acyclovir. Also, make sure to consider other causes besides infectious in this population. For the well-appearing, it's still going to be that full septic workup, including CSF testing, as well as admission. You also need to consider other causes, including HSV. So if they have hypothermia, seizures, hepatitis, or vesicles, make sure to go down that pathway. What about at that 29 to 56 day range? Well, if they're ill appearing, same approach. You're going to do the same approach as the ill appearing neonate. If they're well appearing though, we want to know, is this bronchiolitis or not? Because this will change the pathway a little bit. If we do have a clear case of bronchiolitis, we still want to get urinalysis and urine culture. The big reason why is because UTIs can still be pretty prominent in this population. We should also still consider other laboratory testing, such as the CBC and culture, as well as potentially testing the CSF. If the patient meets any high-risk criteria, then they should be admitted. Otherwise, next-day follow-up can be appropriate, but make sure to coordinate this with a pediatrician. If there's no evidence of bronchiolitis, but they are well appearing, then you want to get the urinalysis, CBC, plus or minus the CRP and PCT if they're available, urine and blood cultures. If they meet all the low-risk criteria, then discharge them home with 24-hour follow-up, like we discussed before with the pediatrician, but do not give antibiotics. If any of the high-risk criteria are met, make sure to admit, obtain CSF testing, and to administer antibiotics. Finally, what do we do between the 57 to 89 day age group? Again, ill appearing, straightforward. They get a full septic workup, including CSF testing with admission and antibiotics. If they're well appearing, it's going to go back to that bronchiolitis or no bronchiolitis. If they have bronchiolitis, you can get away with just urinalysis and urine culture alone. If they do not have bronchiolitis, then you should again consider urinalysis and urine culture as well as other testing such as a CBC, CRP, PCT, and blood culture. If they meet all the low-risk criteria, you can discharge them home with a 24-hour follow-up. Again, coordinate that with the pediatrician and do not give antibiotics. If they meet high-risk criteria, again, it's going to be a full septic workup, obtaining CSF, admitting and administering antibiotics. With the last age group, that 57 to 89 days, usually the antibiotics that we're going to be giving is usually just ceftriaxone plus or minus maybe vancomycin. in some cases. Vancomycin's more if the CSF pleocytosis or if there's gram-positive organisms on the CSF gram stain. If there are gram-negative organisms at any point on CSF gram stain, then you really need to talk to someone with infectious disease for further management. It is vital to remember that no matter what method we use, we need to get our pediatric colleagues involved in the decision-making process. Additionally, if you are newer to this, so you're not as familiar or comfortable with managing the febrile young infant, have support. This is a great time if you're a PA or NP to get your collaborating physician on board. And if you are a physician, especially if you're working maybe a family medicine or internal medicine background, so you're not as experienced with these, get someone who's emergency medicine trained on board or have some form of backup, whether that's a pediatrician or referring that person, that patient, and their family to a higher level of care. This is something that our tertiary care friends should expect because we may not be as comfortable with seeing this and we may not have all the resources needed to even keep that patient. I do want to cover some final pearls from the article. Let's hit off with some of the things we've already discussed. Young infants with a fever can harbor dangerous pathology even when they're not ill appearing. Given the rates of SBIs and IBIs in these populations, a tactile fever or fever at home should still undergo the same level of testing as those with a documented fever in the department. Remember that there can be non-infectious causes for ill-appearing young children, and so we need to consider those in the mix. Neonates all need a full septic workup and admission. They have a high prevalence of SBI and IBI with the least reliable exam. This should include CSF testing on all neonates, as well as testing for HSV in neonates age 21 days or less. And sometimes, again, we can consider older based on the presentation. There have been some changes in newer evidence compared to what we've seen of old. Newer algorithms incorporate CRP and PCT tests. The chest X-ray is being seen more often as being unnecessary unless there are respiratory signs or symptoms that are present, given the low prevalence of disease otherwise. In fact, in some studies, it is zero. In a couple of studies, there still were some serious bacterial infections, but they seem to be from UTIs. Stool studies, such as culture and fecal leukocytes for bacterial gastroenteritis, should be obtained based on symptoms, so blood or mucus in the stool. If the patient does not have these symptoms, you can forgo stool studies. Keep in mind that UTIs are the most common cause of infection, and the most common bacterium that we see is E. coli. Rapid antigen testing and/or PCR testing for respiratory viruses should be sent for all febrile infants with rhinorrhea, nasal congestion, or bronchiolitis. In infants 60 days or younger, they can still have other infections, usually UTIs, and we should consider still obtaining urinalysis on all patients less than 90 days of age based on what evidence is currently out there. Remember, with bronchiolitis specifically, that apnea may be the only symptom in infants 6 weeks or younger in age. If you haven't gathered yet from the recommendations, all young infants less than 90 days of age should really be tested for UTI given its prevalence. Young infants without a clear source of infection and no CSF having been obtained should not receive empiric antibiotics, as this can make the diagnosis of meningitis difficult to do later. What do you think? Do you enjoy the content? Did you feel like you learned something from this? If so, make sure to check out EB Medicine. Right now, you can get $50 off or more with a subscription to EB Medicine. I have links in the show notes that you can go to. If you click on that, you can get your discount and let them know that you heard it from Total EM. Otherwise, make sure to check out some more resources that I do have on the post. And until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.